Our moderator is Mary Mitchell, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. She's an editorial board member. She joined the Sun-Times in 1991, has covered probably everything under the sun, City Hall, the United States Federal Courts. She's published on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. She has written for several national publications. Mary Mitchell is a recipient of numerous journalism awards, including the Award of Excellence from the National Association of Black Journalists, the Studs Terkel Award from the Community Media Workshop, the Peter Lisagor Award from the Chicago Headline Club, and she's a member of the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame. Mary Mitchell was raised in Chicago and earned her bachelor's degree in journalism from Columbia College. Superintendent Eddie Johnson has served as superintendent of the Chicago Police Department since he was appointed in March of 2016. Superintendent Johnson joined the CPD as a patrolman in May of 1988, and he doesn't remember, but he took my abnormal psych class when I taught at the police academy in 1988. He did very well, let me tell you. Superintendent Johnson has served in several supervisory roles, including sergeant in the detective division, the 5th District Gang Tactical Unit, a lieutenant in patrol in the Austin District. He was commander of the Gresham, the 6th District, deputy chief for the area central, executive officer of patrol, and finally, chief of patrol, where he commanded 8,000 police officers. Superintendent Johnson is a member of the executive board of the National Order of Black Law Enforcement Executives, Chicago Chapter, the St. Jude Board of Directors, and the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation. Superintendent Johnson is a native of Chicago. He grew up in Cabrini Green until he was 9 years old, at which time his family moved to Washington Heights, where he continues to reside. Thank you. Our third participant this morning is Sheriff Tom Dart, who I also worked for at one time. As Cook County Sheriff, Tom Dart has brought a very aggressive yet innovative approach to law enforcement. Tom Dart is a former prosecutor and state legislator. He's fought for the rights of others and to protect the most vulnerable members of our society. First elected in 2006, he has introduced sweeping changes at the Cook County Jail, which is the nation's largest single-site jail. He's restructured the sheriff's police force and improved operations of the Court Services Department. At the Cook County Department of Corrections, Sheriff Dart oversees a population of more than 12,000, and that includes inmates both housed on-site and in alternative programs. Sheriff Dart takes whatever steps are necessary to improve and maintain the safety and security of all those housed and employed at the Cook County Jail, and it's not an easy job. If you had the opportunity to read the New York Times this Sunday, they had a three-page story on prisons in the state of New York and what's involved in trying to manage and provide safety to the inmates in those institutions, and Sheriff Dart has done a great job here. In 2009, Time magazine named Sheriff Dart one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Tom and his wife, Patricia, reside on Chicago's South Side and are the proud parents of 5 young children. So let's give Sheriff Dart a round of applause. And let's have our panelists come up to the dais here. We'll turn the floor over to Mary Mitchell. And remember, if any of you have questions that you would like any of the panelists to respond to, please fill out our blue form and we'll collect them later. Absolutely, Mary. It's very safe here, not to worry. Okay, thank you.
Well, good morning. Man, am I really impressed that all of you got up so early this morning. I couldn't believe it. You know, actually, when I accepted this invitation, I thought I was going to lunch. So you come to hear a candid conversation, and as much as I can do that with cameras rolling, we will do that. I'd like to thank the City Club for allowing me to moderate the panel this morning. Hopefully, our two law enforcement experts will answer some of the questions that all of us have about what in the world is going on in our city. We have questions about gun violence. We have concerns about why we can't get the numbers down. And no matter how many times I write the stories, the questions never seem to get answered. So I'll be up front. I've been one of those people who kind of stand on the fence. I understand the Second Amendment right. I want to make sure that I am upholding and respecting the Constitution, and I've been kind of wishy-washy. But then I found out something. When you look at the pictures up here of these young kids, and you realize that these are lives, these are futures, these are families that's represented in our city that are suffering because of gun violence, I can no longer be on the fence. And so what I'm waiting for is a Brown versus Board of Education debate in this country over guns. What I'm looking for is a Roe versus Wade debate over guns. I'm looking for folks to say, I'm mad as hell. And hopefully today we will get inspired and motivated to do something more than talk about gun violence. As noted journalist Gary Young, the author of Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives, wrote, you won't find another Western country with a murder rate on a par with that in Black America. For comparable rates, you have to look to Mexico, Brazil, Nigeria, or Rwanda. Think about that. That's the group we are in. So let's get started, and I would like to say first to hear from Superintendent Johnson, who I must say I admire so much because he's under such tremendous pressure. On one hand, you have the gun violence that's playing out in the streets. On the other hand, you have the police shootings that he has to address more than I'm sure he would like to. The city is closing in on a tragic milestone. More than 700 people have been murdered, the majority of them by gun deaths, and more than 4,000 people have been shooting victims. The city has announced a hiring surge of police officers, and the department has put more resources into police presence in communities most affected. What more can be done? And what can civic-minded folks like the people in this room do to reduce gun violence?
Good morning. I just want to say thank you to the City Club, Jay Doherty, for inviting me this morning. It is an early morning because usually I have very late nights. with a city of 2.7 million people, there's always something you can count on. There's always something going on early in the morning. But I want to thank you all for having me this morning. So listen, it is time for some candid conversation about the gun violence in Chicago. It has, reluctantly, I am discovering that wherever I go now outside the city of Chicago, people are starting to recognize me. and I'm okay with that. What I'm not okay with is that when they recognize me and say, hey, you're that guy from Chicago, then the second thing they say is, boy, you all have a lot of violence up there. And it upsets me because the truth of the matter is Chicago is not out of control. There's certain parts of the city that we have to address the violence. So I want you all to look up there at that screen. Look at those little kids. I want you to look into their faces. Simple fact of it is somebody took away all that they were, all that they were going to be. They took it away from them. I still have the opportunity to go into the African-American neighborhoods And I talk to these parents, mothers, grandmothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, who have lost someone. And I have to tell you, they are sick and tired of seeing what we're seeing. As an African-American man, if you all haven't noticed, I am African-American. And I live in the African-American community. So my neighbors, when I go home in the evening, first thing they say to me is, "Hey, Eddie, what can you do about this violence? Why is it that we keep seeing the same guys do the same things?" And I have to tell you all, CPD does a fantastic job, despite the national narrative, the scrutiny all across this country that law enforcement is under. Do we make mistakes? Sure we do. Are we perfect? No. But the majority of police officers, not just in Chicago, but around this country, swore an oath to protect and serve, and that's what they go out there every day and try to do. Right now, CPD has recovered 8,000 weapons year to date. 8,000. Think about that for a moment. That's twice as many as New York and L.A. combined. And that's not because we're that much better than them. That's because we have that many guns out on the streets of Chicago. When you look at our judicial system, law enforcement, judicial system, our elected officials, our judiciary, everybody has a vested interest in keeping the city of Chicago safe. That's our obligation. When you know that a person that steals a pack of hot dogs and jewels because he's hungry spends more time on average than a guy caught with an illegal firearm in jail. They spend more time in jail on average prior to their court date. That's ridiculous. This is something is dreadfully wrong. First-time gun offenders in Chicago, on average, spend 6 months in jail. For their second offense, they spend a little over a year and a half. For every subsequent offense, we're talking a little over 2 years. That's bizarre. It's unacceptable. The gun violence in Chicago is unacceptable. That's why I have been talking so hard with our state legislators to get this repeat gun bill passed. Now, I'm no fan of mass incarceration or disproportionate arresting of minorities. But the simple fact is this. If you pick up a gun and shoot somebody, I don't care how you rap, black, brown, polka dot, psychedelic, it doesn't matter. You should go to prison. It's as simple as that. And until we change the mental culture of these people that's picking up these guns, we're going to continue to see this cycle of violence. Now, I would give you that violence in the city is more complex than that. Mm-hmm. It is. There's a lot of other things that we need to do, like invest in impoverished neighborhoods. But we have long-term solutions, we have short-term solutions, and then we have urgent solutions. This is urgent. Look up there. If that doesn't tell you, it's urgent. When you leave here today, I want you to burn in your memory 711. 711 people have been murdered in the city of Chicago today. 711 lives. 711 families that won't see these people for Christmas this year. Any leader in this city that thinks that that's okay and that we can sit by idly and do nothing should not be a leader. We have to do something. That gun bill is just a part of it. More police is just a part of it. It's going to take a lot of other support to get this gun violence down. But the upside of it is that we can fix it. So I don't want to take up all the time this morning, so thank you.
Quite welcome. You answered the question. Because I think at the end of the day, what we really want to get to is what can we do? Which brings me to Cook County Sheriff Tom Dark. You've made headlines nationally on many issues, but lately for advocating for the elimination of a cash bail system for nonviolent, low-level offenders. And that all sounds reasonable, but I need to know, why do you think this will reduce the kind of violence, or if you think it will reduce the kind of violence we've seen in Chicago? And what do you say to the naysayers who believe that such a strategy at this particular time gives the impression that we are somehow letting lawbreakers off the hook?
Well, the naysayers, like usual, are wrong. I'm always right. The measure that we've been talking about with the bail provisions, the thing that's fascinating about it is that if you look at it, it's logic-driven. And what I mean by that is there's analysis done of everybody that comes in front of a bond judge, and there's values attached to how violent they are, their history, do they show up for court or not show up for court. And then after that's done, you're basically put in one of two lanes. One lane says that you are violent, and we could absolutely care less how wealthy you are, how wealthy your gang-banging buddies are. You're staying in jail. And the other lane says, listen, you are no more dangerous society than I am, and so as a result of that, we also don't care how much money you have. And so the fact that you have no wealth, you have no family members that have any wealth, doesn't mean you have to sit in jail because you're poor, which is something I see all the time. And so, A, it's a straightforward concept, but the thing that a lot of people don't understand, one of the first places that came up with this was in Washington, D.C. And the superintendent and I have been talking about a lot of things lately, and when I was mentioning it to him, the thing that was fascinating about it, when they came up with it in Washington, they came up with it as a tough on crime. It was tough on crime. Reason being is in Washington at the time, they were seeing too many violent people getting out. And they were upset with the fact that they saw people clearly were violent, were going to commit more violent offenses, and yet they were getting out. And the sad thing is that we've seen this thing play out I don't know how many times. Eddie has the stories galore. I have them. But if I can just give you just a couple of them. One is just over a course of a month, we were studying the bond court. And during that period of time, people charged with gun offenses, okay, who had like a cash amount assigned to them to get out or not, 25% of them came up with the money. Mm-hmm. During that same period of time, people charged with retail theft, 4% of them came up with the money. So they sat, and the guys with the guns left. And then you ask yourself, okay, well, what's the end of that? Well, the end of it is Eddie can tell you, he has to say, countless stories. Let me just give you like four of them. And these are not old ones either. A guy named Kevin Lenoir, arrested in 2016, UUW a felon. An arrest violated his probation that he was on at the same time. So the judge set a $105,000 bond on him, meaning he has to come up with $10,500. He came up with it. He came up with it about a month after he was in custody. What he then did in July of 2016, so a few months after that, he was charged with shooting at three people, allegedly killing a 32-year-old man in front of his house. He's back in jail now on a murder charge. Kevin Martinez, 21 years old, arrested January 2015, charged with aggravated UUW, $100,000 bond. He comes up with $10,000 a couple days later, 2 days later. April 13th, okay, so a few months later, Chicago police had Martinez was a passenger in a car that chased an off-duty officer and fired two shots at the officer. He's now in jail on attempt murder charges. And here's one Eddie and I were talking about the other day. Pierre Stokes, you might remember this one. He was charged in June of 2014 with aggravated assault and UUW of a felon while on parole. $90,000 bond. He posts the $9,000. Then on March 18, 2016, he shot three people at 79th and Ashland. He's in jail now facing attempt murder charges. Probably as relevant as anything else is he is the father of 9-year-old Tyshawn Lee, who was shot to death in the fall of 2015. I have other ones, too, and they all have the same drumbeat, which is that the wrong people are being released. And the wrong people are sitting there all too often, and this is just a much more thoughtful way to proceed.
Okay. So, but isn't this a matter of, I mean, when you say this, that the last example you gave, that he had only post $9,000, I mean, wouldn't that be an example of the court not putting a high enough bond? I mean, $9,000, he came up with $9,000. Try coming up with $90,000. Try coming up with an amount of money that would put a violent offender, someone who's been accused and charged with other gun illegal gun offenses, that would seem to be the problem. The other thing is, why do we not see retail theft? And retail theft is a terrible thing, you know? I mean, I have some Bay cousins that have gone to jail on retail theft because they got another problem. You know, so they're in jail, they get out on a bond, they still don't get treatment for their substance abuse or whatever problem that has them going into stores stealing things. Why is that not seen as a gateway to the other thing, which is now you, after doing the retail theft, you go do something else, and now you got to have a gun? So I think that there's an optic problem here on the part of a lot of people, that overall we have this giant problem of gun violence, and then we have, on the other side of it, we're letting people out of jail.
Well, and see, the problem is, underlying it, is the lack of logic in what we do here. Because mm-hmm. you think about it, we're a pretty smart society. We should be able to come up with plans here. Start with something Eddie and I once again talked to. Neither one of us, when I signed for sheriff, Eddie signed up for superintendent, neither one of us got the memo saying, oh, and by the way, you guys are going to be at the front end of dealing with the mental health crisis in our country.
Right.
That wasn't something anyone got, mm-hmm. but that was thrust upon us. Why do I bring that up is that, so we're dealing with those issues. Those issues have solutions. You put those people in the right place, which is not a jail, frankly. You put them in programs where we follow up on them. The traditional program for like a mentally ill person, to give you an idea of how illogical the system was, is that when it's time to release, no matter when it was, whatever time of the day it was, whatever time of year it was, it could be February at midnight, they walked out the door with a plastic baggie with a week's worth of their drugs. That was it. And then we all asked, puzzled, why are they coming back in so often? Well, I would say, what do you expect's going to happen? Of course they're coming back in. We set them up to fail. And with people charged with retail theft and things like that, the beauty of what this bond program talks about is that everyone is gauged with all the different issues they have. And so some people will be released because they're not violent. Literally, they're just released, and they have mm-hmm. to come back to court. Other ones have electronic monitoring put on them. Other ones are required to go to drug treatment while they're out as well. Mm-hmm. There's like this thoughtful process that's unique to each person, with the goal being that their success is the goal for each person, and each one is unique. And in doing that, too, we've talked about this. If you think about it, if we can clear out all the people who don't belong in the criminal justice system, whether in the jail or, frankly, being taken into custody, mm-hmm. we have more time, more resources, more energy for these people who are really bad, and who are hurting people.
You know what? Let me jump in for a moment. So, listen, with the, you know, Tom and I talked about the bond issue, the bail bond issue, and at first I didn't understand where he was coming from with it, but after he explained it to me, I'm with him. Now, here's the thing. Gun offenders, you all have to remember something. If you think that gangbangers don't sit around and discuss things like we're doing right here, you're fooling yourself, because they do. When we, first of all, people that commit gun crimes, let's say they're a stick-up man, that's a profitable occupation. Mm-hmm. So they, and then let's take it a little further. What Tom is trying to do is keep those violent people in jail. The shooters for gangs, the gangs need those guys. Believe me when I tell you. I believe that a lot of the gang members, if we give them a different path, give them some hope, we can steer them in a different direction. But the simple truth of the matter is, some of those individuals like doing what they do. I've had gang members tell me, some of the heads of gangs tell me, hey, boss man, you got to get rid of so-and-so because he's just a killer. And I'm telling you that to tell you this. Those individuals, no matter how high we put that bond at, the gangs will put their money together because they want that guy out there because he'll go get that rival gang member that they're trying to get. So no matter how high we push it up there, they're gonna figure out a way to get this guy out of jail. He should be sitting in there. Mm-hmm. The mental health aspect of it, Tom and I were talking about that. It blew my mind when he told me, he asked me, did I know what the largest mental health facility was in the country? It's Cook County Jail. That's ridiculous. People shouldn't have to get arrested or go to jail to get mental health treatment? They shouldn't. On the front end of that, CPD has to deal with these individuals. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of societal ills have been dumped at the doorstep of law enforcement, and we are doing our best to catch up and train our folks to be able to identify people in mental health crisis. But the simple fact of it is, they shouldn't have to go to Tom to get mental health treatment. That's ridiculous. We should be giving them, because here's the thing, and I want you to understand this. If we don't do something to correct the whole system, like when they go to correctional institutions, they should get corrected. Because even if we do get the judges to sentence these repeat gun offenders to the high end of the sentencing scale, what do we do when they come back out?
Correct.
What do we do? So the idea is to put them where they deserve to be, because they've earned that spot. They've earned it. But then we have to put programs in place to correct them when they get in there so that we won't have to deal with them when they come back out.
And one of the other things, too, that Eddie was just talking about, because as I say, the two of us go back and forth on this stuff frequently. I can't emphasize enough to you how much the criminal justice system, frankly, throughout the country, has missed the boat and missed it horribly. And this isn't just because I run the jail that I want to make sure all the resources come to me. No. The vast majority of times when you talk to people about reentry programs, getting people ready to come back to the street, they almost always are talking about programs in the prison system. You know, that's the norm. You know, people go to prison, we got to work with them, so when they come back to the community, they do a good job, and they don't commit crimes and whatever. The reality of it is, last year, in 2015, it was the last numbers I had, the entire Illinois prison system, all of it, released about 30,000 people back to the community. I released over about 45,000 people, okay? And so the whole time, the system has never said, you know, jails are the place we got to focus on interventions. Jails are the place we got to put strategies together. It's always been the prisons. So the entire criminal justice system throughout the country has been missing this forever. And yet, on an average day, we're throwing about 150, 200 people out into the community every day. And until we came up with some of these really interesting programs that we operate here, they usually just were heading out the door, which is the norm throughout the country, mind you. But how is this helping our communities? How is this helping Eddie? How is it helping anybody when you take people who've had this contact with law enforcement and you keep them housed in a facility and then you just spew them back out in the street? It doesn't help. And so that's why, whether it's on the front end, better determining who needs to stay, or when they're released, have a plan. And the plan can't just be you send them out the door and then wait until they interact with law enforcement again. Because as Eddie said, certain people are going to have certain patterns, but we have come across numerous people. And we've started a lot of pretty interesting programs. And I was just talking about contextuals earlier today to try to break cycles. It can be done. Because as Eddie said, different guys are in these things. They're all unique. Some guys are evil, absolutely evil. They need to be locked up forever, absolutely forever. Absolutely forever. And if someone wants to go out on the prison system and play some games with them and figure out what got into their heads, go for it. Knock yourself out. But for the majority of them, they're coming back into the communities, and they're very, very fixable. Right. They're fixable if we have a plan. But if your plan is no plan, that's our plan, no plan, well, you're going to get that then. You're going to get complete chaos. And when we looked at some of the people we were working in the jail, people that, much like with Eddie, you know, we sort of target people that we believe are going to be the ones either involved with violence or the victims of it. They are coming from 15 different zip codes, okay? And they're going back to these zip codes. And if we aren't preparing them for that and building partnerships there, we might as well forget about this thing. Because as Eddie said at the outset, this is complex.
Okay. So let's talk about the elephant in the room. A lot of blame has been placed on Mayor Emanuel for the crime surge. In fact, recently, the FOP Executive Director, Jim Pascoe, says the mayor runs the department like an arm of his political operation, with far greater attention being paid to rhetoric and optics than to the reality of the situation on the street. As the city's top cop, what is your response to such accusations? And how much decision-making power do you really have when it comes to making the critical kinds of decisions needed to address the continuing gun violence?
You know, That comment is funny to me. It really is, because I can't speak for how the mayor was prior to me being a superintendent, but I can tell you this. Since I was appointed superintendent, we have had a great partnership. He's been very supportive, but he doesn't dibble-dabble in the affairs of CPD. He doesn't. Because one of the things, when he approached me about becoming superintendent, I have to be clear on this. One of the things we talked about was, I don't know how to be a politician. I have no idea what that lane is all about. And I ain't trying to find out. What I do know how to do is be a cop. I've been a cop 28 years. I know what it takes to do what it is we do. You know, there's a reason police officers handle things the way they do, because you develop a police acumen. So I know what we need to do, just like, you know, the reforms that we've made. I knew coming in some of the things that we were deficient at that we needed to fix. So I didn't need to sit around and wait for somebody to tell me what to do. I brought it to him. This is what we need to do. And he's been very supportive. The mayor and I talk maybe once or twice a week, maybe, you know. So that right there should be an indication that he doesn't run CPD. If he wanted to run CPD, then he could have been the superintendent, you know. But he charged me with that, and I'm doing the best that I can. He's been very supportive of what we need to do. As far as the decision-making, myself and my executive staff, we huddle up, because Eddie Johnson would never profess to be the world's smartest person. So I have a group of people that I bring in, and they make recommendations to me. At the end of the day, it's my decision which way we go. But I have to tell you, it's funny to me, because I didn't really know the mayor before I became superintendent. Mm-hmm. We didn't know each other like that. But I have to tell you all that I've been pleasantly surprised, because everywhere that I go, people that know him talk about the micromanager in him. And that may very well be true. But with me and CPD, he lets me and CPD run CPD as it should be.
Okay. So I know we have some other questions. You guys have great questions. I'm going to ask this last one, and then we will move on to taking questions from the floor. November saw more than twice as many murder victims than during the same period of time last year. And that would include, you know, when you think about those numbers, the fact that you have made much effort, put much effort into policing the kind of communities where, the communities affected by this gun violence. What would account for such a dramatic increase?
Well, the number one thing that's accounted for, I can tell you that, is just as plain as the nose on my face. Sometimes we look for complex reasons, and we miss the simple stuff. I can tell you all this. The guys out there, first of all, we got a city of 2.7 million people, right? You all have heard me talk about the strategic subject list, which has roughly about 1,400 people that we know are driving the violence in our city. Our repeat gun offenders, or I shouldn't even say our repeat gun offenders, our gang members in the city of Chicago think that our judicial system is a joke. That's why we're having so much, such a spike. Now, don't get me wrong. We, CPD, got off to a rocky start this year because of what happened at the end of last year with Laquan McDonald and all of that. Mm-hmm. We've righted the ship. We've stabilized things. And your police officers want to be the police. Don't get me wrong. They're cautious because of the national narrative that's out there right now. So they're careful about how they do police. But at the same time, the biggest reason for this spike is because our repeat guys just don't fear the judicial system. CPD, the men and women in CPD, do a fabulous job arresting them. Otherwise, we wouldn't have more gun recoveries than this time last year. I think we're over 8% higher in overall gun arrests than we were last year. That tells you that the police are doing their part of it. But like Tom said, we're dropping a ball somewhere. And we keep letting these guys out. For example, last year, of all the homicide offenders we arrested, people for first-degree murder, 40% of them, 40%, almost half, had prior gun convictions. So what is that telling us? It's the same guys that choose that lifestyle. So until we fix that part of it, which is why I'm pushing so hard for this repeat gun offender bill, because until we change the mental culture of these individuals, we have to teach them, you don't even want to pick up a gun in Chicago. So until we get there, we're going to continue to see this cycle of violence.
And Eddie, and now, the bill Eddie's talking about that he's been working on, the mayor's office been working on, is common sense. I can't conceive of how someone could oppose this, but then once again, we are talking about Springfield. So, but it's necessary. It'll be helpful. Because I talk to a lot of these detainees in some of our programs, and I'll ask them. I say, you know, tell me a little bit about what is going on the street. I'll do it normally in a way because I don't want to come to them and say, tell me why you did X, Y, Z, because they'll clam up. But if you ask them what's going on in the street, they'll walk through the logic. And the logic is, as Eddie just mentioned, everybody has a gun. They all have guns. And when you ask them about, you know, what about the penalties about getting caught with a gun, they don't care. And they absolutely have told me over and over again, they say, you know, Sheriff, I'd rather have a gun out there to defend myself, because if I'm alone walking and someone comes up to me, they all got guns and I don't have a gun, I'm going to be dead. I'm less concerned about coming in here because I won't be in here that long anyways, so I'd rather have the gun with me. So you add that mentality, which is very, very real, and there's a logic to it too. There's a logic to it. You add that to the fact there's guns everywhere. And then you add to it the fact that we have this incredible social media world now where things that nobody in this room would consider even worthy of a response, but to some of these guys, some of these slights on social media is more than enough to go and kill somebody. And then that cycle keeps going and going and going. And the breaking down of the gang structure, Eddie's talked about it. We've talked about it. We see it in the jail all the time. Good luck when it comes to trying to house these guys, because the fact that they're both GDs off the same block doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean anything. And so then you're trying to keep people separate and all the rest. I'm not trying to mention that just because of how difficult it makes our job, which it does, and we have some great people working there, but it speaks to the complexities of what we're talking about. Guns everywhere. Laws that are by and large ineffective, and then the mentality of the young men, almost small young men, that are out there, and that leads to this volatile mix that we have here. And so the things Eddie's talking about, we've been talking about, are things that are very helpful, but once again, Eddie and I use the same word all the time. It's complex, it's difficult, and you have to be in it for the long haul. If you think there's like one solution, then you ought to quit right now. There isn't. It's a couple different things that are going to move the needle quicker, but then the long road is these communities, stabilizing them, giving these guys opportunities. And one final thing before I suck all the air out of the room, Mary, is that I remember when I first became sheriff talking to a guy, and he was getting out of the jail, and I was actually just talking to him because I was trying to find out how we had treated him while he was there. And he says, you know, this is the best way, the best I've ever been treated here. And I was like, well, obviously you've been here before then. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. And I go, but you don't want to be here. And he goes, no, absolutely. I want to get back home. I've got a kid I want to take care of, and I got to get out of here. And he says, I am. My case is going to be, I'm pleading out to probation like later that week. And I said, that's fantastic. Good. I said, good luck. I hope things work out. And I asked him, I go, now, explain to me why I should think that you're not going to be coming back in here. And the guy paused for a bit, thought, and then he said, you know what, Sheriff, I'm probably coming back. And I said, well, now, why is that? You just told me you don't want to be here and you don't like it here. Why are you coming back? And he said, you know what, I'm not blaming anybody. And he absolutely wasn't. He said, the community I'm going back to is the community I've lived in all my life. There weren't a lot of job opportunities when I left, and now I have a felony conviction. It's going to be trickier now, so I'll try to get a job. I most likely won't get one, and they're always looking for someone to sell dope. And he goes, I'll do that because I need money, and eventually you guys will catch me again. And then you add to that this volatile mix of guns and everything, and you can see how all this is coming together. So there is logic behind it. There's things we can do. There's things we are working together. Eddie and I have been working on quite a few things lately, and now we're going to start having sheriffs, police officers actually in cars. We're actually in Englewood right now, and we've been on the west side a lot. We're actually, Eddie and I were just talking yesterday, we're going to actually put some of our guys in cars with CPD guys, too, to further merge our two operations as well. So a lot of good things are going on, folks, but this is very complex.
Thank you, Sheriff, and I'm sure the 7th District is glad to hear that. Mary, you have a whole bunch of questions. We'll try to answer as many as we can. I want to let some people from the media ask questions. I'm sure that our speakers will be available afterwards, but the questions are really from members of the City Club and their guests. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so we'll start off with a question from Bob Gallo, AARP, Illinois. My friend Melissa's son was murdered by a gangbanger. Her 13-year-old son witnessed it. Now she keeps her younger son inside because he has been labeled a potential snitch. Along with Melissa, how do they get protection now?
So listen, we do partner with the state's attorney's office in terms of giving people protection. We relocate them if they think that they're in harm's way for testifying. But let me just say this. That's one of the reasons we've been working so hard at CPD to reestablish the trust between the communities and the police department, because the simple fact of the matter is the police very seldom, up until last week, witness a lot of murders in front of them. So we need the community to give us that information so that we can hold these individuals accountable, because gang members, they count on that. They count on the public being fearful of their retaliation. But why are they like that? Because the gangbangers don't fear the judicial system, which is another reason we got to get this thing fixed. But we do work with the state's attorney's office to give them witness protection.
Okay, thank you. This one is from Christine Hefner. What are the obstacles to bail bond reform? What will it take to get the FOP to accept changes that make it easier to discipline bad cops? That's a tough one. We've been trying to figure that one out for a long time. What, if any effect, will be a Trump president? What, if any effect, will a Trump presidency have on what was a growing movement for criminal justice reform?
I'll take one of them, Eddie, and you can take one. I think I know which one you'll take. I guess on the last one, I don't think anybody has any idea of what Trump presidency is going to mean for criminal justice reform. They really don't know. The one thing I will tell you is over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, this is an issue myself and many other people have been talking about for like a decade, so this isn't something new to a lot of people. But in the last 2 years, maybe three, there's been a lot of people from all over the spectrum. So you're talking the typical, I guess, you know, advocates, but then you also had people from the Koch brothers who have been very, very adamant about changes in the criminal justice system. And yeah, some motives are different, but underlying a lot of it is people have done the analysis, and frankly, once again, sort of what we're talking about, the system's broken, and as a result of being broken, is inefficient and outrageously expensive. And so I think that given all that, there'll still be a lot of mood to change the system. How it's actually going to play out, I'm not completely sure yet, and I don't think anybody really knows, but I think, you know, we're all just going to sit and wait a little bit.
What was the first part of that question?
Yeah, I forgot the not second one.
The first part of that question, Superintendent, what will it take to get the FOP to accept changes that make it easier to discipline bad cops?
So the FOP is, of course, in charge of the contract negotiations for the rank and file. I've had several conversations with the president and, you know, just simply said to him, we have to be flexible on both sides of this equation. So hopefully when contract negotiations come around next year, they will be mindful that we do need to be flexible in order to ensure that the rank and file has what they need, but also that the public gets what they need from their police department.
And the other part of the question dealt with bail bond reform. There's going to be a slew of concerns by people, I'm sure. And I think a lot of the hurdles, frankly, will just be we're breaking with tradition, and it's frankly traditions going on around the country where you set numbers to bond and things like that. So I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle. It's just getting people to think differently, that the old traditional way of doing it doesn't work. And we understand that this is going to be a little bit of a project, and I've already heard from some people opposed to it, and we're working with people on it, but it's going to be a project.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Okay.
Mary?
This is from McCraven, Illinois Department of Corrections, for Sheriff Dart. You worked very closely with Judge Harold Sullivan on expungements. Do you believe in amending the Criminal ID Act to allow more people to exit the criminal justice system?
Yeah, you know, I don't use this word with my kids, but you do find yourself saying, let's just try not to be stupid. You think about it, once again, you don't have to be a bleeding heart. You don't even have to be that outrageously thoughtful. You just have to be someone that's looking for results. When you look at the way we discharge people from prisons and jails, I mean, literally, if you want to sit there and say, hey, let's figure a way to make sure this person fails, you couldn't think of a better way. And so whether it's working with getting people IDs when they leave the facility, that's a must. You have to have that. Otherwise, they can't do basic things. But beyond that, you have to start thinking in terms of what is it going to do for this person when they're leaving so they have an opportunity for success. And they're only now beginning to study that when you allow things to be on people's records that have no point, it really hurts them when it comes to jobs. And one of the things we changed this past year on expungements was this one was so stupid. It said that if you had if you were 18 and you committed a crime and say that event was not expungible, for good reasons not expungible, the next 25 years of your life, you're the best citizen in the world, and you got arrested for something goofy and the case was dropped, you could not remove that case from your record. It said if you've ever been convicted of something that was not expungible, you can never get anything expunged off your record. Now, you explain to me what the logic is there. There's none. There's none, unless you're sitting there saying to yourself, let's make sure this person's unemployable because that works for us somehow. And so we changed that. We pushed to change it so that you wouldn't have to pay because there's like a $200 fee, something like that, you had to pay to expunge your records, even if you didn't do it. And that one I had to pull back on because people were looking at the revenue. And I kept telling them down in Springfield, guys, you're not listening to me. He didn't do it. We can't keep charging him when they didn't do it. And they're like, well, we make a lot of money off of that, Tom. And I was like, you clearly are not listening to me. He did not do it. And they're like, yeah, but we get a lot. Oh, forget about it. But so there's a lot of things in the expungement world we need to do if we're serious about giving people options so they aren't getting back in this.
Okay.
Thank you. Mary?
Next question is from Carolyn Grisco, and it's for Superintendent Johnson. What are you doing to address the murder closure rate, which is under 30%?
I think they mean murder clearance rate?
Yes.
Okay. So the murder clearance rate is and I kind of refer to it as not a CPD clearance rate, but a Chicago clearance rate. So there's a couple of things that we have to do to improve our clearance rate. The first thing, I think, if we improve the trust with the community, especially the minority community and CPD, that will help raise the clearance rate because then those individuals will be more comfortable in coming to us, giving us the information we need to hold these individuals accountable. The second thing that we're doing over the next 2 years, we are promoting about 350 new detectives. So that will increase the detective division by about 40%. Their caseload, especially for shootings and homicides are very high, which you all can probably figure out. So we're going to give them additional 350 more detectives, and I think that along with restoring the public trust would go a long way to improving our clearance rates.
Okay, and Sheriff Dart, here's a question about bond court. I know you've done some reforms there. What is the average time in bond court right now?
My understanding, it's gone up recently, but then again, I don't think conceivably it could have gone down any further. The Appleseed Foundation, which is a nonpartisan group, did a study, I think it was 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, where they went into the bond court down 26th Street, and they timed it, okay? And mind you, I'm a former prosecutor, so I can sort of speak to the fact that in the criminal world, when you have a case, the two most significant events is obviously whether you're guilty or not, so either because of a trial or a plea. That's number one. But number two is your bond hearing and whether or not you're sitting in jail while you're waiting on your case or whether you're home with your family, you're going to your job, you're going to school. When the Appleseed folks studied this thing about 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, and mind you, in a bond court, there's the judge sitting there, and then there's the public defender, there's the state's attorney. State's attorney is reading the person's record. Public defender is talking about this person and why they have connections to the community, why they're a good risk, their job history, all that stuff. When they timed it, the average time was under 20 seconds. And so you try to explain to me how you can have a thoughtful decision made when the second most important event is taking 20 seconds. And then you talk about like when Eddie was just referencing now about when you're trying to restore, you know, faith in people that, you know, the system is not against you. I mean, when you're just moving people in front of judges and out the door they go and you're giving them 20 seconds to decide whether or not they're going to be sitting in jail, what do you think they're going to feel? Are they going to think that we as a society are really taking this seriously and we're thoughtful and we think, you know, that you're another fellow human being? Of course not. So it's extended. It's gotten a little bit longer now. And in the last, I think, 6 months, it's gotten even a little bit longer. And frankly, there's been a lot of scrutiny, too. So I don't think there was this great epiphany all of a sudden. It was, you know, people were watching. And so there's been more scrutiny. But it just speaks to the fact that our system as a whole needs to have more thoughtfulness put into it.
Okay. This question is about cure violence and ceasefire. I was on a panel recently, and Gary Slutkin, who is over cure violence, mentioned that in the police districts where cure violence used to be active, that there has been a 40% increase in violence in those districts. Now, I don't know the numbers. I mean, I have not gone back and tried to figure that out. But this question is on that. It's from Graham Grady, and it says, do you support programs such as cure violence and ceasefire, which work to stop retaliatory shootings, or do you oppose these programs because they refuse to provide info to the police?
Now, you know what? Anything that will help reduce violence, I'm willing to take a look at and partner with. We partnered with Ceasefire a couple of years ago, and it didn't work out well, but I think that the theory of the program is solid. But what we found out was that some of the people, the interrupters that were supposed to be helping us stem the violence, they were being ceasefire by day and slinging dope by night. And that doesn't work well with the rank and file police officers. When they see these guys out there doing nefarious things, they just don't – it's just not a good mix. Mm-hmm. But the CURE folks, I haven't had a chance to talk to them. But ceasefire, now I will say, is under new leadership now, so I will be willing to sit down with them and take a look at it.
With CURE violence, that would be Gary Slutkin's group?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so the next question is from Kimball, LADIENMD, from Safe Haven, and it's for Sheriff Dart. A penny of prevention is worth a dollar of cure. Instead of tearing down the jails, how about using the buildings as halfway houses where individuals on probation, parole, would go to work programs daily, also use space for adolescent boot camp, including schools, tutoring, and counseling programs. What do you think of that proposal?
Well, for a couple things. One are the facilities that are being taken down there, A, have been empty for a few years now. B, they're old, and they're very, very expensive to upkeep. And so there was a lot of thought put in as far as what was coming down. Two, the halfway house idea is a good idea. I really like it. We've kicked it around a lot. I guess the good and the bad of it is we have other options because we have a lot of abandoned structures, so we don't necessarily need to do it there physically at one of those buildings. So there's other options of where we can do a halfway house that might even be more thoughtful, that might be closer to the community where people are at. And the third part of that one I have already forgotten.
It was an adolescent
boot camp. Oh, the adolescent boot camp. I got rid of the boot camp that we had at our place. All the numbers that I had looked at from, frankly, around the country did not show that they worked. I mean, frankly, it just was not showing that you being in that boot camp made it less likely you're going to get involved with crime, or that you then had a trajectory of a good career and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was the program that we went and sort of blew up, and we turned into this really incredibly cool program that I literally invented out of whole cloth, where we teach people construction skills. We go out to communities. We rip down abandoned buildings. We've ripped down, I think, close to 200 buildings now, some of them really large. And in doing it, though, we've taught these detainees these outrageous skills. They're transferable. The unions are working with me. I think they've hired two or three so far, and I'd like more. But we took that idea and decided let's give them skills, because the military weren't taking these folks, for starters, which was the underlying reason originally for boot camps. But boot camps were really, really expensive, and they didn't have results. So there's some good juvenile programs. I wouldn't call them boot camps, but there's some other things to do with juveniles. I, you know, for the good and bad, but don't interact with the juveniles. I just deal with adults.
Okay. All right.
Time for a couple more questions, Mary.
Okay, so this one is a goodie. Rebecca Levin and Robert Lurie Children's Hospital is for you, Superintendent Johnson. You have mentioned the need to have greater sentences for people who shoot someone. But when Senator Raul discusses the bill he's been working on with you, he mentions repeat gun possessors. Can you please clarify and describe the data about how many people will be affected and the expected impact on crime and violence?
okay, so the impact on crime and violence would be huge because these guys are the ones that's driving the violence in Chicago. So let me be clear about something. The individuals that we're targeting are folks that would be going to jail anyway because they've committed the crimes that dictate that they would go to jail. What we're trying to do is ensure that these individuals, that their sentencing is equates to what the crime is that they committed, so they're not getting a slap on the wrist. So the judges will still have discretion to deviate away from the mid to high-end range of the sentencing bar. So we're not changing the sentencing guideline. But so they'll have the autonomy to deviate away from it. It's just that if they do, then they have to put in writing so that everyone will know why they are deviating from the sentencing that this individual should have.
Yeah, you know, as a former prosecutor and a former legislator, I can tell you that, that usually people get caught up in the word mandatory minimums, and there's all sorts of studies showing they didn't work, they weren't as effective. People talked about it. Mandatory minimums will, you know, take away discretion and say if someone's convicted, this is what they get. This bill does not have that. This bill has, as you know, the superintendent just mentioned, it has the ability for deviation. So that if a judge does come across a case of an individual who is worthy of a second chance or isn't as egregious as you might think, they have the ability to deviate. They just have to put it in writing. And so the notion is that the bad guys will get the proper sentence, and those few cases where it would not be in the interest of justice to sentence someone to an extended time, they have that out. So a lot of time and energy has been put into this a lot, and I commend the people involved with it because they've tried to anticipate all that.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to close now. And but I'm going to guess one more final question. What is the biggest unmet mental health need in Cook County Jail?
Frankly, it's not in the jail, and unfortunately I can speak to that because the detainees all tell me over and over again the best treatment they get is the jail, which is outrageous, and that people want to come there because that's where they get the best care and treatment. So the biggest need is out in the community. There's some great, great people, but they've been absolutely eviscerated over the course of years of not having mental health funded. And the outlook is pretty bleak right now, too, given what's going on down in Springfield. So what we're doing now is we're stabilizing people, we're working with them, we're putting them in great programs with us, but then when we go to hand them off to the community, there's very few partners left. The ones that are out there are amazing people. How they've hung in there, I'll never know, but we have turned our back on these folks. And then think about this for a second. As Eddie can speak to as well as anybody, when these folks go into crisis, once again, law enforcement was not supposed to be mental health professionals. But who are the people getting the call? When some loved one has somebody going in crisis in their house, they're usually not calling the hospital. They're calling police because the guy's got a bat. The guy's got a knife. He's threatening to hurt himself. But those things escalate. They get out of control, and especially when you have people that weren't trained to do these things. And Eddie's folks, my folks, we all have this new training that, you know, helps a great deal. But at the end of the day, it's what we're trying to do is we're taking a problem, we're asking the wrong people to handle it. And then at the end of the day, people are puzzled. But once again, when you can't hand them off to the proper people in the community, what do you expect is going to happen?
Right. So at the end of the day, the common denominator here for me is the gun. There's no getting around it. There will always just like... The word says there will always be the poor. The poor will always be among us. So is the criminal element. And I would argue that a gun is a lethal weapon. And on the streets of Chicago, there are people, thousands of them, walking around with lethal weapons. We have to be clear about that. And we have to take a stand.
Well, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give our panelists, our moderator, a round of applause.